comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
Everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. This is your host, Eric Mann, and this is still Martin Luther King Day, week, year, every year. And I have been doing a lot of thinking about Dr. King, which I do all the time. I think all the time about Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer and W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson and Franz Fanon, and just a lot of my friends who have shaped my life. And I have a great love for Dr. King, and especially a great hatred of how the system treated him when he was alive, including assassinating him. And if it's imaginable, even worse, assassinating the historical record of his truly revolutionary life and revolutionary political thought. So in that context, I worked all weekend on an article called Martin Luther King and the Black Revolutionary Tradition, which was published yesterday in Counterpunch magazine, www.counterpunch.org. I really want to thank my editor, Jeffrey Sinclair, who's just incredibly supportive as a writer who believes on the other end is an editor who really wants your stuff, and he ran it, as he often does, as the lead story. And I've gotten some wonderful responses. So that is to say, emailed responses, Eric at Voices from the Frontlines. So what I'm going to do today is first I'm going to read you the actual article and continue the work about Dr. Martin Luther King. Secondly, I'm going to read you a lot of the emails and responses I got, which I thought were very helpful and interesting. And then we're going to go to the phones and listen to your response again to the article and to Dr. Martin Luther King and your own thoughts about his own life. So in that context, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. I want to thank Nina Simone, as always, for raising my morale. And here goes. So from Counterpunch, it's called Martin Luther King and the Black Revolutionary Tradition, and I'm Eric Mann. As we celebrate the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr., the system, the white power structure, as we used to call it and still should call it, continued its character and political assassination of his work. Dr. King rejected the myths of U.S. society. He rejected its madmen packaging as, quote, the leader of the free world, to tell it like it is. That the United States is, in his words, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Dr. King saw, again, his quote, the Negro Revolution, as part of a third world and world revolution. I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. In my own reading and rereading of so many books on Black revolutionary history, here are a few appreciations of Dr. King's role. Number one, Dr. King understood that the civil rights and black liberation movement was from the outset a battle against the system itself. King understood the intersection of radical reforms and social revolution, and was always working to understand the time, place, conditions, and balance of forces that would shape his rhetoric and tactical plan. King was one of the greatest and most effective reformers of all. And yet, in confronting the system's intransigence, his own revolutionary outlook kept evolving. King's prominence began in 1955 in his leadership of the Montgomery bus boycott, the same year as the murder of Emmett Till and the Bandung Conference of Non-Aligned Nations, to begin what turned out to be the two decades of the 60s that did not end until the defeat of the United States in Vietnam in 1975. Despite the U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn school segregation, in the case of Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, the great Greensboro sit-ins of 1960, the exciting work of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Congress of Racial Equality Freedom Rides of 1961, the conditions of black people in the United States remained at criminal levels. By 1963, white Democratic Party terror in the South and Democratic Party racism and brutality in the ghettos of the North had generated a great deal of militancy, organizing, and consciousness, but little change in the system. At the Great March on Washington in August 1963, King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, along with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, NAACP, Urban League, and A. Philip Randolph's Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters took place amid an air of hope, but also great impatience and militancy. King's I Have a Dream speech, a phrase that was not even in his initial draft, was in fact a revolutionary indictment of U.S. society. This is now quoting from his speech. 100 years later, after the formal abolition of slavery, the Negro was still not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languishing in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. So we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. King continues, in a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come back to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. King is imploring, cajoling, but what his words make clear, threatening U.S. society and trying to mobilize black rebellion. When he says crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of segregation, he's making it clear that slavery is in fact still in place. He describes the United States as a society that offers the Negro bad checks and broken promises. When he says we refuse to believe the Bank of Justice is bankrupt, this is code for we know you're morally bankrupt, but black people are here to demand, as the Staples Singers demanded, when will we be paid for the work we've done? King's formulation of the fierce urgency of now and the tranquilizing drug of gradualism was a frontal assault on President Kennedy and the Democrats' cry for patience in face of injustice. King countered with the spirit of freedom now, the cry of black militants in South Africa, South Carolina, and the South Bronx, and supported by a growing number of white supporters of the civil rights movement. In fact, now, was one of the revolutionary slogans of its time, and President Kennedy and the whole world was listening. One of King's revolutionary observations that is still painfully relevant today was, quote, "The Negro is still languishing in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land." In 1964, I was recruited by organizers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to join what they called the Civil Rights Revolution. By the time I got to CORE in Harlem in the Northeast in September of 1964, my mentors were staying up all night debating what exactly that revolution would look like. While the struggle focused on democratic rights and full equality, many SNCC and CORE leaders were talking about some form of a black nation, black power, black militancy, black separatism, not as a way of getting away from the system, but as part of a plan to challenge it, and for some, overthrow it. Clearly influenced by Malcolm X, but also the African liberation movements, people were talking about a challenge to U.S. capitalism, and at least talking about some type of pro-socialist system. It was not all that clear or delineated, but the concepts of full equality, full democratic rights, black rights, self-determination, radical reform, a black nation, and revolution were far more interrelated than counterposed, and all of them involved black people in the leadership of a multiracial movement, either through integration or separation. In that context, I am not arguing that Dr. King was a black revolutionary nationalist, but he was a student of world history and was impacted by the revolutionary ideas of the times. For Dr. King, as early as 1963, to tell the President of the United States that black people in the U.S. are, quote, exiles in their own land, was clearly a call for some form of both full equality and black self-determination, and far away from the more perfect union myth that the system was selling with very few buyers. 2. Dr. King was a victim of capitalist state violence, surveillance, psychological, character, and actual assassination. The story of J. Edgar Hoover's campaign to destroy Martin Luther King and force him into a nervous breakdown and suicide is not tangential, but central to King's revolutionary history and the surveillance and police state we live under today. And yet, another element of the revolutionary history of Dr. King that is being whitewashed is his actual assassination was by the system of itself. Part of this cover-up is to destroy the memory of the work of Coretta Scott King in exposing the actual assassination of Dr. King. In his "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech, the very night before he was murdered, Dr. King was very aware of what he felt was his possible and imminent assassination. "Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing anymore, any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." And while his words are brave, every time I hear that talk, I hear a mortal man not fully at peace, nor should he have been, with his mortality, but trying to comfort and reassure black people that we as a people, we as a black people, will find liberation, rather than asking them to protect him, which he knew they could not. On December 8, 1999, 21 years after his death, after the King family and allies presented 70 witnesses in a civil trial, 12 jurors in Memphis, Tennessee, reached a unanimous verdict after about an hour of deliberations that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated as a result of a conspiracy. In a press statement held the following day in Atlanta, Mrs. Coretta Scott King welcomed the verdict. These are her words. "There is abundant evidence of a major, high-level conspiracy in the assassination of my husband, Martin Luther King Jr., and the civil court's unanimous verdict has validated our belief. I wholeheartedly applaud the verdict of the jury, and I feel that justice has been well served in the deliberations. This verdict is not only a great victory for my family, but also a great victory for America, is a great victory for truth itself. It is important to know that this was a swift verdict, delivered after about an hour of jury deliberation. The jury was clearly convinced by the extensive evidence that was presented during the trial that, in addition to Mr. Jowers, the conspiracy of the mafia, local, state, and federal government agencies were deeply involved in the assassination of my husband. The jury also affirmed overwhelming evidence that identified someone else, not James Earl Ray, as the shooter, and that Mr. Ray was set up to take the blame. I want to make it clear that my family has no interest in retribution. Instead, our sole concern has been that the full truth of the assassination has been revealed and adjudicated in a court of law. My husband once said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Today, almost 32 years after my husband and the father of my four children was assassinated, I feel that the jury's verdict clearly affirms this principle. With this faith, we can begin the 21st century and the new millennium with a new spirit of hope and healing. Sadly, the police, surveillance, counterinsurgency state is stronger than ever. But at least there's growing public challenge to its hegemony. Understanding the revolutionary story of Dr. King and the system's decision to bring him down is essential if we want to understand and make history in the present. Number three, Dr. King was from the outset a black militant and revolutionary who advocated nonviolent direct action but saw the Negro Revolution as the overriding objective. While he strongly argued for nonviolence as both a tactical and ethical perspective, King supported the right of black people to armed self-defense and allied with the advocates of armed self-defense and even armed struggle in the black movement. At a time of the most rampant and systemic police violence, the system's armed requirement that black people are, quote, nonviolent is intellectually and morally lethal. It flies in the face of the long-standing tradition of armed self-defense in the black community and the urgency to defend that tradition today. Worse, to use Dr. King against that basic right is the height of cynicism and historical distortion. Clay Carson, in his book In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s, helps shed light on this complex relationship. While many young organizers were critical of Dr. King, SNCC's Stokely Carmichael explained best their appreciation of his profound impact on the black masses. As Stokely said, "People loved King. I've seen people in the South climb over each other just to say, 'I touched him, I touched him.' I'm even talking about the young. These were the people we were working with, and I had to follow in his footsteps when I went in there. The people didn't know what was SNCC. They just said, 'You one of Dr. King's men?' 'Yes, ma'am, I am.'" Carson explains the pivotal role of militant and self-reliant local black residents who owned weapons and were willing to defend themselves when attacked. Black rallies in the county were often protected by armed guards, sometimes affiliated with the Louisiana-based Deacons for Defense and Justice. Many SNCC organizers, in disagreeing with King's focus on nonviolence, explained, "We are not King or SCLC. They don't do the work, the kind of work that we do, nor do they live in the areas we live in. They don't drive the highways at night." Carmichael recalled that the discussion ended when he asked those carrying weapons to place them on the table. Nearly all the black organizers working in the Deep South were armed. But again, the system wants to act like the battle between King and SNCC and the black militants was a morality play or an ideological war, but it wasn't. It was an intellectual, strategic, and yes, ethical struggle among equals. And King was both open-minded and introspective about the limits of his nonviolent advocacy. And as such, people had great respect for his own principles and rationale. And I want to add that in the focus on nonviolence, the system hides King's advocacy of nonviolent direct action. Have you ever seen what it looks like? Have you ever seen 100 black and white people marching into a bank, marching into a discriminatory company, marching into a police station, yelling, "What do we want? Freedom. When do we want it? Now." Yelling at the top of their lungs, shaking their hands and shaking their fist at the police. That's nonviolent direct action. And if you don't think that the police will kill you for nonviolent direct action, or if you think the system really loves nonviolent direct action, you try carrying it out and see how they'll treat you. In 1965, James Farmer, the director of CORE, a truly dedicated pacifist, told a group of us in a mass meeting, "I'm completely nonviolent, but I want to thank our brothers from the Deacons for Defense, who are both standing guard and, yes, getting a standing ovation from the organizers, whose arms allow me to be nonviolent." My read of history as King felt similarly. And even more importantly, King well understood that his nonviolence could be used by the system as a justification for state violence and, of course, the system's need to destroy the Black United Front. In his speech Beyond Vietnam on April 4, 1967, King addressed frontally his most principled conversations with the angry youth of the urban ghettos. He stated, "As I've walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I've told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I've tried to offer my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent direct action. But they asked, and rightfully so, well, what about Vietnam? Their questions hit home, and I knew I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government." I'm going to continue reading. This is Eric Mann. I'm reading from my article, Martin Luther King and the Black Revolutionary Tradition, that is up on the excellent magazine, webzine, counterpunch.org, www.counterpunch.org. And this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. That's, of course, at KPFK. 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm going to continue. Note that King does not try to raise a moral critique of those who would use Molotov cocktails and rifles in response to the economic and armed violence of the state. And by making clear he considered its advocates, quote, the oppressed, he supported the morality, if not the tactics, of their cause. Instead, he simply argued that he did not feel it would, quote, solve their problem. And even then, he qualified his own advocacy of nonviolence to make the case that, quote, social change comes most meaningfully, but not exclusively, from nonviolence. He admitted it was a legitimate debate. Martin Luther King Jr., SNCC, CORE, and Malcolm X represented at the time the left wing of the Black United Front, the black militants of the Black United Front. But they worked to find strategic and tactical unity with the NAACP and Urban League. And only because of that Black United Front made the March on Washington, the Civil Rights Bill, and the Voting Rights Bill possible. While King had many contradictions with the young black militants, he understood them, and they him, as strategic allies against the system of white supremacist capitalism and imperialism. 4. SNCC, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and M.L. King were on the forefront of the movement against the U.S. war of aggression in Vietnam. While SNCC and Malcolm were among the first to speak out frontally against the war as early as 1965, by April 1967, both King and Muhammad Ali took enormous risks to frontally challenge the war on moral grounds and to argue that black people in particular had no interest in supporting the war. In his monumental Beyond Vietnam speech, Dr. King argued in support of Vietnamese self-determination and rejected the view that the U.S. had any legitimate interest in Vietnam. Reading primary documents is essential for the revolutionary historian, strategist, tactician, and organizer. In reading and rereading Beyond Vietnam, I still hang on this every word. King called out against U.S. war crimes against the Vietnamese people, making the analogy that the United States feared the most, comparisons with Nazi Germany. He asked, "What do the Vietnamese people think when we test our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested our new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe?" King praised the integrity and legitimacy of the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, including the communists, who he argued were the legitimate political leaders of the Vietnamese people's struggle. King said, "They were led by Ho Chi Minh and were creating a revolutionary government seeking self-determination." He describes Ho as saved only by, quote, his sense of humor and irony when he hears the most powerful nation in the world speaking of aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a nation 8,000 miles from its shores. Communists with a sense of humor and irony? Perhaps the most revolutionary insight of all. King focused on demand development. In the end, movements are unified by ideas, by people, by organizations and demands. King ends with saying, "The U.S. must end all bombing in North and South Vietnam, declare a unilateral ceasefire, curtail the U.S. buildup in Thailand and Laos, recognize the role of the National Liberation Front in any future Vietnam government, remove all foreign, that is, U.S. troops from Vietnam, make reparations for the damage." This was tantamount to calling for immediate U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam. It recognized the victory of the National Liberation Front and argued for what would later become a critical component of black people's demands against the U.S. government, reparation. The story of the system's attack on Dr. King once he spoke out against the war in Vietnam, and his courage in the face of this assault, is another chapter of Dr. King's revolutionary contribution to U.S. and world history. One important version of that story is Tavis Smiley's documentary, Death of a King, Dr. Martin Luther King's Final Year. Dr. King brought a powerful and frontal indictment of the system of white supremacist, racist capitalism. He appreciated the ideas of others and worked to build a black and multiracial united front against what he called racism, poverty, and militarism. He was willing to confront the cowardice inside his own bosom and modeled how all of us have to put our bodies, our souls, and our lives on the line. He rejected gradualism and demanded freedom now. He advocated nonviolence, but defended the right of those who disagreed with him to armed self-defense. He rejected a U.S. chauvinism. He called for a militant internationalism, and he challenged the U.S. empire at home and abroad. He was independent of, and yes, willing to challenge and confront the Democratic Party. He was and is a great contributor to the endless struggle for human and planetary liberation. It is time to celebrate the Revolutionary King on the anniversary of his birthday. We do not have to agree on every aspect of his life and history to thank Stevie Wonder, who spoke for all of us when he wrote, "I just never understood how a man who died for good could not have a day that would be set aside for his recognition, because it should never be just because some cannot see. The dream is clear as he, that they should make it become an illusion. And we all know everything that he stood for time will bring, for in peace our hearts will sing. Thanks to Martin Luther King. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you."
birthday to ya. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday to ya. Happy birthday.
Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. We're still on Martin Luther King's birthday. And we're going to go to the phones, 818-985-5735. I'd like to hear some of the young people on the front lines of today's struggle. I'd like to hear some of us who are fortunate enough to actually live during the time and heard, while he was alive, the voice and seen the work of Dr. Martin Luther King. This is your host, Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. 818-985-5735. And since I've asked a lot of you to send me emails at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com, we've gotten some wonderful emails, both from the Counterpunch readers and from the Voices from the Frontlines listeners. If you go on our site, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and register, you get a weekly news bulletin from us every Tuesday morning about what the show is going to be about. And we sent the article out to those of you on the list ahead of time. Got some wonderful comments already today. So please send me emails at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines, and I will try to read them. So I got a couple before we go to the phones, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Open to all members of all races, but in particular our black members on Dr. King's Day. We'd love to hear from you. Here's one from a Jarrell Shaw. Sir, I really enjoyed your Counterpunch installment, MLK and the Black Revolution. To me, it not only reflects the depth and breadth of the work of Dr. King, but it speaks to the depth and breadth of your own work. I did want to mention the word gradualism. That, to me, jumped off the page. And remember, 818-985-5735, if you'd like to talk about Dr. Martin Luther King's revolutionary legacy. It's my feeling that black leadership and those who seem content today in a so-called post-racial society have become gradualist in a way versus revolutionary, still trying to cash a blank check of promises and settling for a trickle of returns. Sad occurrences like Ferguson are events that ironically can awaken us to continue the unfinished business of getting full justice. I'm sure that Dr. King would be impressed with this monument in the mall, but probably sad about the continued conversation of gradualism. There's much more, but I'll end by saying that the revolution lives on. Then, I want to thank Peter Lundbaugh, who simply said, thank you for your fine words on M.L. King that appeared in Counterpunch. From Michael Hager, it said, in blog comments, I quoted Coretta's statement also. Thanks for putting Counterpunch on the record. Much more has to be done so that January 15th becomes associated with a demand for accountability. This would be a breakthrough for black history and establish that curbing the security state is the King family legacy. This is an opening for reassessment of the domestic assassination program to which other key leaders, including a president, were exposed. 818-985-5735. Let's go to Roy in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Eric.
Hey, Roy.
I'm all right. Listen, Eric, you know, you were singing along with Dr. King, and I heard you before that, and you gave a lot of love because it sounded like you break up. But, Eric, I want you to know, back in 1967, I was there on 125th Street when Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy, Percy Sutton, Cassius Clay, Floyd Patterson, that's after he had fought Floyd Patterson and win. I was there on 125th Street, marching behind Dr. King, and I went to Washington, D.C., 1977 and 1978 to do my part to make sure his birthday was ratified, because the first year we went, we didn't have enough, but the second year, they turned out everything, the treasury and all of it. And that was the greatest thing I felt I'd done in my life. And I've done quite a few others because you know my people out of South Carolina, the International Law and Showman them. And I have seen Dr. King movement made a great era in the life of black folks. So anybody that don't stand up with these young folks now today, it will never be completed. Eric, you're good people. I thank you, and I thank you for your work.
Roy, it means a lot. You know, I think we come from a very similar age, and we were given a great blessing. It's for a lot of the young, gifted, and black, and Latino, and other great people today. I think you're going to help us make the revolution now and lead the revolution now, because we were so lucky to have seen a revolution, to be part of a revolution, to see Malcolm in the flesh. I was at Malcolm's funeral when Ossie Davis talked about our black sweet prince. And Roy, thank you so much. Call again. You know, you have a very rich history. And yes, the struggle in South Carolina of the longshoremen and the black longshoremen who led that struggle. It's in my book, Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of a Successful Organizer, story about Bill Fletcher and that whole union organizing both black liberation and labor union struggle. 818-985-5735. Love to hear from you on the phones. Who do we got next, Alan? How about Gigi in Pasadena? 818-985-5735. We're honoring the revolutionary life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Hi, Eric. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, there. Hi. I listen to you. Love your show. First time caller. I walked in from walking my dog, Sparky, and you were playing the music. So after I danced myself around the room, got goosebumps, and to calm myself down, I said, I got a call. Did you mention Selma? Because I was out walking the dog. Did you? Because I went to see Selma.
I talked about Selma for a couple of weeks. I just want to say one thing that's very important to me is that the fact that the lead actor, David Ayalolo, did not get nominated for Best Actor, and that the director, DuVernay, did not get nominated for Best Director, I assumed, and yes, I raised some concerns about the film, but I assumed a great deal of unity. And the fact that the Democratic Party and the Johnson people went after that film and denied them a nomination, and that's what happened, waging a white supremacist campaign against that film, is a crime on Dr. King's birthday, and we should all go see Selma. If you saw it once, see it again. And as we say, you tell the white power structure that whatever debates we have about that film, compared to American Sniper, give me a break. You know, I mean, I don't mean meaning it's the exact opposite. So, no, I did not see it, and I want to thank you for your call and keep dancing.
Okay.
Hey, Mike. What's up, Mike? Van Nuys.
Oh, just I just want to hit on four or five quick points really quickly.
Mike, you got one. Make your first
okay.
one. What's your main
okay,
one?
Okay, well, the Beyond the Vietnam speech, I read it word for word, still brings me to tears. I think, for me personally, it's his best speech. I like the line where he says, "We're always mesmerized by uncertainty, but we must move on." I think that's his most powerful speech. Forget American Sniper is a joke. It's garbage. And I like what Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report, Bruce Dixon, they always talk about the black misleadership class. And we don't have people like MLK of any color anymore, and it's really sad. So
thanks for your call.
Thanks for talking about it.
And I want to say this, that we I think we should really pay attention to that. There's always a debate about so-called misleaders, but let's not underestimate the vast majority of leaders, and also to be careful even about the concept of misleaders. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to say over and over and over again is a black united front means that people of different classes, different perspectives, different class interests, different philosophical points of view are essential if we have any chance for black liberation, socialist revolution, progressiveness, a united front against fascism. We have to be very careful to impugn the motives of other people, to assume we know better, to assume our point of view is the correct. Go do our work. Prove our work in the streets. Have a generosity of spirit towards other people. There is not a black person in the United States, regardless of their philosophical point of view, who is safe in the streets of the United States, including the President of the United States. So I don't like the concept of misleaders. I think we have a lot of leaders with different points of view. And sometimes, yeah, we're mad at each other. We don't like each other. We judge each other. But in the end of the day, I don't want to break it to you, when the Klan is marching down the street and the Klan is the United States government, we're all in the same foxhole together. So I like Glenn Ford and I like Black Agenda Report, but let's be clear. Without the Black United Front, there's no hope for anybody. Let's see, 818-985-5735. How about Elaine in Hollywood? How you doing, Elaine?
Yeah, hi. I'm a white female, 80, and I went down to Texas. I'm from the north, totally ignorant on segregation, sat in the back of the bus. I was going to become a minister. They wouldn't let me because I'm female. I was going to get arrested. Then I left. I said, there's no white Christian in the South. So that's my story. And I listened all day yesterday to all of the speeches by Dr. King.
Well, thanks a lot, Elena. And on that, I want to thank KPFK and the whole Archives Project. I also listened to many of the speeches. What an interesting guy. I mean, I don't know. He's one of the most caricatured. I mean, that's part of racism, right, is that a man of such great intellect, of such scholarship, Dr. King, he wasn't a medical doctor. He was a PhD doctor in divinity. He was a philosopher. He studied rhetoric. He studied organizing. I heard a speech he gave yesterday about how the nations of Africa, and I heard this on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and you don't have to wait to a fund drive, by the way, to call up and give money to the station, because it's just invaluable. And he was saying about how the nations of Africa are taking giant, giant steps, and the Negro people or the black people in the United States are just beginning to take steps. His point was to create a solidarity with the African revolutions. So when I say about the urgency of now, he was very influenced by Freedom Now. He was very influenced by the black GIs who came back from World War II armed. He was very influenced by the black sharecroppers. He was influenced by Jewish theologists. He was an intellectual in the very best sense of the word. You can't get enough of listening to his speeches. What a great mind. And I think one of the reasons there's such condescension towards him by the white power structure is how much smarter he was than them. So who else have we got here? 818-985-5735. Arthur in L.A., how are you doing, my brother?
I'm doing fine. Gee, every time you speak, it's remarkable. I was calling to to say, yeah, I listened to Mr. King's speeches, the ones that the KPFK has just released, and I sat mesmerized. I wouldn't go in the house so that I wouldn't have to turn off the car. It has just entirely blown me away what KPFK has put out today. And I wanted to say, listen, was that you singing Happy Birthday?
Among others, yeah.
Well, it's a real human voice. And I've heard all the other people saying really wonderful things and you saying wonderful things, but that was real personal. And that was brave of you to put out your voice like that. I'm one of those people who has a voice similar to yours. And it was great. And
well, thanks a lot. Let me move on. I want to tell you that in the civil rights movement, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. If you didn't sing, if you didn't march, if you didn't sing, you got it. If you didn't come in with a sense of rhythm, you went out with one. If you didn't
That's
sing
right.
when you came in, you walked out with one. So thank you, my brother. Let's go to another
thank
caller.
Thank you, brother. Take care. Great
right.
show. Always, every time.
Thanks so much. Kirk in Montebello, how are you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, I wanted to say it's not a surprise that the film King, the film Selma was snubbed because it seemed so much, it placed so much of a focus on the economic and social vision of King instead of just the civil rights. And that's the kind, when you said caricature earlier, that's the kind of thing that they're doing. They're trying to caricaturize King as only being about civil rights instead of extending his extended vision of the economic realities that he was pushing for at the end of his life.
Well, thanks. And I think one of the things that's important to understand is that we used to call it racist capitalist America in one word with a K, of course, America with a K. We didn't separate the civil rights movement from the economic struggle, but rather we understood that the very basis, I talked about the staple singers, When Will We Get Paid for the Work We Done, is a song about the exploitation of black labor. This country was built on black labor. So the intersection of race and labor, the role of the black worker, the black workers in Memphis the day that he was killed. So rather than seeing that King understood economics, trust me, if you're at the bottom of an empire and you're black, you understand economics. So thank you so much for the call, 818-985-5735. Shai, are you still on the phone on North Hollywood?
Yes, I am.
What's up?
I want to know, how can those of us who are white, I am almost 60, how can we best support the black movement? I don't think that it's got to be the young and old all up front, but how can we help?
You know, that's the only question worth asking. You know, a lot of times when I go to see movements, when I heard Cesar Chavez, when I heard the civil rights movement, you know, they don't say, well, what's your relationship? But how can I help is the question. I would say this. There are so many organizations. I'm just going to mention my own as one, the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Community Rights Campaign that we have right now. We are right now trying to get no tanks out of L.A., and we just got a letter from Cortinas, the new head of the school board, when we asked him to get rid of what's called the 1033 program, where the Los Angeles School Police Department right now has military-grade weapons that it receives from the Defense Department, and we've asked the school board to get rid of those weapons. And yes, as a black liberation struggle, as a Latino liberation struggle, and so far, they have not yet, to say the least, said yes. So I suggest as one example, 213-387-2800, call the Strategy Center. The other thing I would say to all the white folks in L.A., and I mean this in the most sincere but hopefully biting way, is the east side of Los Angeles is not La Cienega. And if you don't go to South L.A., if you don't go to King and Crenshaw, if you don't go to the Los Angeles Unified School District, if you don't go to the MTA, if you don't see races, if you don't go to the LAPD hearings, we need white people because black and Latino people in this country are so devalued and oppressed that they will always be leading the struggle. But yes, some white people can create a little bit of an edge to help. I want to make sure we get one more caller in, 818-985, but thank you so much for calling. That was the right exact question. We got 1 minute, G? 1 minute. All right, well, I think we're going to leave again. Let's all sing again with Stevie. How about that? We got a minute and a half, and I want to make sure that we thank G. I want to thank Crystal McMillan. I want to thank Alan Minsky. I want to thank KPFK.org. And I mainly want to thank, always thank, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We love you. We'll never forget you. Keep singing, keep dancing, keep fighting, keep marching, keep struggling. Freedom now. All power to the people. Nonviolent direct action. The right of armed self-defense.
And you're listening to Voices from the Frontlines with host Eric Mann here on KPFK.